Struggling to keep track of your story and world? Archivos is for you. More intuitive than a wiki, more extensible than Scrivener, Archivos builds your story Bible into your personal, always-on tactical display. Graphical relationship charting, continuity tools, this thing has it all, with bonus options for fan engagement and real-time collaboration. I don't recommend tools I don't use, guys, and this one is good enough that even Open Source Me is using it for one of his projects instead of my trusty old wiki. Archivos. Story world management done right. www.archivos.digital. That's www.archivos.digital. Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life.
Well, hello everybody, and before we start today's episode, I need to extend my apologies for the abnormally long break, especially in the run-up to episode 1000, as we have been. I am deep in final revisions of two books that are just waiting on me to get out into the world. And my whole brain has been caught up in it, and although we have recorded all these episodes, I had not actually edited them yet, so in my head they were done, and of course the queue ran low, and then ran out, and then I kept ignoring it because, oh, there's only one more day to finish this book, and it has taken a lot longer. So, you have my sincere apologies for all of that. Meantime, I hope the beginning of July is treating you well and that things haven't been too exciting in the wrong ways, but maybe have been more exciting in the right ways than they were over the winter. Today's episode brings on two-time Prometheus Award winner Travis Corcoran, who won the Prometheus Award for each of his two books, the lucky bastard. He and I ran into each other on Twitter about, I guess it was last December now, in the midst of the run-up to the pandemic, and we were talking about a lot of the same things, and he has also hit on a similar strategy that I have in terms of financial security when pursuing a high-risk career like writing. So I am bringing him on today to talk about the different pitfalls in financial security and being a writer and thinking of your writing as an employee would think of their salary, and the interesting and weird way we have both independently arrived at to square that circle and turn the disadvantages of writing into a series of nested advantages that, ironically, make us hardier proof against the kinds of unrest and difficulties that are going on worldwide and in the United States right now. So I offer to you this conversation, which I hope will be at least entertaining and perhaps useful. Here you go. Travis, welcome, welcome. It's good to have you on the show. It's been fun raising hell with you on Twitter lately.
Yes, it is. And thank you for having me here. It's great to be here. And as we were discussing in the sort of pre-roll intro thing, you and I have a lot in common, both as writers and with the whole homesteading thing. So I'm looking forward to talking about that.
Several years ago, I read the Nassim Taleb book, Anti-Fragile, and then loved it so much that I went back and read Fooled by Randomness and The Black Swan and carried on through Bed of Procrustes and To Skin in the Game. Mm-hmm. One of the things that he advocates as a high-risk day trader is that when you're in a high-risk profession, or indeed if you want to maximize your gains in any field, because in most moderate-risk fields, the moderate risk is actually an illusion caused by the slice of time you're looking at, which we can see going on in the world right now as there's a financial crash and a lot of people are losing their secure jobs.
Absolutely. I remember when I was a young, naive, like 24-year-old libertarian, and I was talking with an older and wiser sort of intellectual sparring mm-hmm. buddy. And I was saying, financial security is very simple. Just put 10 or 15% of your income away every year, and it's guaranteed to compound, 11% a year. And, that's the kind of thing that 24-year-olds yep. say. It's not the kind of thing 50
Yeah, it's true as long as market conditions obtain, and they don't always do that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But that really caught my attention because at the time, I was coming off of the financial crisis in 2008. It was a little after that, mm-hmm. but the level of risk exposure that my household had, as not just me being a freelancer and a writer, but my partner also being a freelancer and occasionally having a full-time job, was really, really sharply brought home to me. And so we started trying to formulate a way to lower the risk profile and to move towards something that Taleb argues, which is called the barbell strategy.
Mm-hmm.
He says that in any field, you get rid of the middle range risk, where things feel safer than they are. And you load everything you can onto the ultra safe, completely secure as you can get. And then you put a small percentage of your efforts and assets towards extremely high risk stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that way you are exposed to an unlimited upside, or at least a potentially unlimited upside, and very sharply limited downsides, regardless of which way the system breaks.
I strongly agree with that. And, you know, you're talking about 2008. It's pushing me near to a panic attack, because I'm right there with you, buddy. You know, I launched a startup around the year 2000. Although the word startup is maybe supposed to be reserved for things that go exponential or quickly go away. And this was the worst of both worlds, sort of middling mm-hmm. along for a long time. And 2008 came, and, you know, I had sort of personally co-signed for huge amounts of corporate debt. You know, it's underwater. Yeah. Underwater by about $500,000 dollars, and tried to pull it out just, you know, for the employees and other people who sort of believed in it and had built their lives around it. And failed, you know. So a couple of years after the crash, I finally went fully underwater and declared bankruptcy. And that really recalibrated my thoughts about risk. And so when I moved out to the homestead a year or so after that, my absolute highest priority was to get out of debt and never be in debt again.
Yep.
And
We deleveraged about 15 years ago, and we've managed to keep that situation, which is a huge relief. The thing a lot of writers do not seem to get is that writing is a very high-risk profession.
Yeah.
With the weird caveat that by being in as much control of it as you are, you have more potential for risk management than you do in a day job.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
you are exposed to all the risks that your employers feel every day,
right,
rather than being insulated from them.
No, you said something earlier, which I absolutely agree with, which is that things that look like medium-risk strategies or low-risk strategies often aren't. That's just sort of the superficial veneer on top of reality.
Yes.
And so, you know, you work for a firm, and, you know, they never come out and sign a contract with you and say, we promise you, you know, against these bonds and, you know, stocks and guarantees, we promise you that you've got a job for life. But they certainly allow you to get that impression. But if you, you know, were to speak to your manager or your manager's manager or his manager, their forecasts plus or minus 25%, and they've got all sorts of contingency plans. Oh, if this happens, we'll lay off 10%. If this happens, we'll lay off 20%. So there's a perception management that's going on there to keep you. And I don't want to sound like a communist. You know, the bosses are lying to the little guy. You know, it's just how the world is. And when you strike off, whether you're becoming a writer or some other sort of sole proprietor, you get the gift of clarity.
You see the world for what it really is. The thing that you're actually gaining when you're an employee of someone else is you're outsourcing your bookkeeping.
Right, right.
And if you're an employee for a sufficiently well-run company, and it's hard to know from the outside what those are,
mm-hmm.
you're buying a certain amount of shock insurance mm-hmm. against minor economic perturbations. But in a major downturn, the big firms head south.
Yep. Yep.
Right after the little firms do.
And, you know, to be fair, I mean, obviously you and I both like the sort of self-employed non-corporate life. But to be fair, there are a few valuable things that the big firm brings you.
Oh, for sure.
You know, one of them is just sort of effectively lead generation.
Yes.
You can concentrate on whatever your job is and not have to hunt, you know, what you kill.
Yes.
You can just do the job itself. That's nice.
Yeah, no, and there's nothing wrong with it. But as a writer, you have to get, especially if you're mm-hmm. an indie publisher, also very good if you're going the traditional route, you need to get the risk exposure through your head, because a lot of people that write into this show talk about how long until I can make mm-hmm. my living off my writing.
Right.
And my answer is always never.
Mm-hmm.
Never. You make your living off of secondary income that you generate through investment from the money you make off your writing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because you can't count on the market.
I've got a friend who's a writer, and he used to be a software engineer, transitioned to writing full-time, and he's a very good writer. I quite enjoy his stuff, and every time something new comes out, I'm there on the first day. But as the market shifted and changed, and, Amazon's algorithms changed, there's, always uncertainty, and he saw his income take a really big plunge after a couple of years of doing great. So I can't agree with you more that you've got to build that security basket first.
So you and I have both stumbled upon a similar approach to building that security basket, mm-hmm. and that's basically to farm.
Right.
As unsexy as that sounds. In your case, you actually have a proper working farm. In my case, I have a 20-acre plot that I'm doing groundwork on so that we can move on there and basically never get evicted from where we live. And then at that point, start growing enough of our own food to insulate ourselves against supply chain shocks and other things like that.
Outstanding. That's effectively exactly where I am. Same course as you, just a couple of years earlier. I moved to the farm in 2014, I guess. So I'm now in my seventh year here. And, we get something like 75% of our calories off of the farm. We raise.
Not bad.
Yeah.
And in New Hampshire, too. That's impressive.
Yeah. It's not Alaska. We get summer, 90 degrees outside. But yeah, we raise pigs and sheep, ducks, chickens. And, for much of the year, the sheep eat off of the pastures. So I'm, involved in sort of pasture management, rotational grazing.
We should put a pin in that and come back to it.
Sure. 'Cause
I've been deep in geekhood about that lately.
Okay. Cool. Well, good. When we talk about that more, I will also plug my Kickstarter that's running as this podcast is going to go live, which is on my homesteading book.
All right.
But yeah, when the whole COVID thing broke, a bunch of people online who weren't as constrained by the sort of groupthink of normiedom could tell back in, January or so, like, this is going to be noticeable, not necessarily, end of civilization, but now is the time to stock up on masks and gloves and toilet paper and food.
Yeah, I believe you and I bounced off each other a couple times in late December going, could be the big one.
Exactly. And happily, it turns out to be not as big as, we might have feared, but it's still pretty real. But with all of that, my wife and I didn't have to do much stocking up. We have got, dozens and dozens of steel restaurant shelves in the basement full of pressure canned soup and stock. We've got 3 chest freezers, one full only of pork that I raise on the farm, one full of beef, one of poultry and other things.
Nice.
Yeah, I think we last went shopping 4.5, maybe 5 months ago off the farm. And, we haven't even made a noticeable dent. And that's not because, sort of a doomsday prepper scenario, although not.
It's a nice insulator. Yeah.
Right. You do your harvest and fall, and you do your slaughter and butchering, and the freezers are entirely full. So yeah, lots of good food in the basement.
Yeah, when this all came down, I was alone here. I'm at homesteading boot camp, basically, at a relative's place at the moment.
Wow.
And everyone else was gone when it started to hit, and so I went around and made sure I had 5 months of food for everybody should the supply lines go down.
Nice.
And since then, we've just been sort of topping up stock to keep it rotated.
Right. Cool.
Now, something you have a lot more experience with where this is concerned than I do, because I haven't gotten to my own place yet. When I was growing up, I had grandparents who were farmers, and one of them was a massively unsuccessful farmer. And went bankrupt when the farm reforms in the early 60s came through, dairy market reforms in the early 60s came through, and just no business, no head for business at all. Now, what I'm going to be doing and what you're doing is a little different than commercial farming, but there is still the question of how do you do this and not go broke like the stereotypical farmer does.
Right. So, this is something I talk a lot about in the farms, in the homesteading book. There's a lot of misconceptions about this where, idealistic people say, oh, you're on a farm. That's great. Not only do you get all your own food, but also when everyone else is hungry, you can be selling food. And, and there's a bunch of varieties of sort of, lack of realism. And I don't want to, lack of realism is kind of harsh, just, lack of awareness or lack of knowledge. Farming is a commodity business. And in economics, there's sort of 2 kinds of businesses. There's businesses where you are a price setter. Apple gets to pick how much iPhones sell for. They can make up any number they want, and then they learn something about the supply and demand curve.
That's the value add business.
Right. And when you're selling a unique product, you get to put the price on it. But if you were selling a commodity product, the interactions of the marketplace, every producer and every consumer out there have determined a price, and that has, you know, very little to do with your thoughts on the matter. The last business in the world I would want to get into is selling commodity carrots or commodity potatoes or whatever.
Yeah.
And so now you can do decently on a small farm or a small homestead selling the exact same thing that someone else is selling into a commodity. But the trick is to do value add and to do branding. So you
you do it artisanally. You grow a variety that maybe isn't being served by your local supermarket, stuff like that.
Right. Do it better. Have a story. So, you know, you're not selling pork bellies at, you know, $1.73 per pound, which is what the Chicago Mercantile Exchange Board has. You are selling, you know, Frank's home-style artisanal bacon at, you know, $11 or $15 a pound or something. And you've got to have a story. It's, you know, smoked over a particular kind of log, and you've been experimenting with your recipe for 9 years. And lots of people do that, and lots of people make a decent living doing such things.
If you do that, you have to go through farmers markets, because if you go through large distributors, oh, the permitting, as well as the scaling problems.
Right.
But on the other end of things, if you're just growing for your own sustenance, there's the one of the things that gets commodity farmers is the rolling credit problem, where they borrow in order to get this year's seeds, this year's livestock feed, and then they pay it off at the end of the year once everything goes to market in order to roll forward, and they hope to take their profit out of that. And anytime the market shifts during the middle of the year, they take a major hit, and that's why family farms go under.
Right.
So how do you manage that end of the risk?
Sure. The very short answer is a heck of a lot of hard work. And so you were talking earlier about Nassim Taleb and, you know, sort of making yourself anti-fragile. And having been burned by the crash of 2008 and having felt a sort of tremendous emotional and psychological pressure for years as I was sort of trying to deny reality and fight my way out of it, after I finally, you know, gave up and wiped my hands of that and moved to the farm, the first thing I did is said, you know, I'm going to get out of debt and I'm never going to go back into debt again. And I worked two jobs for about 5 or 6 years. So I was working, you know, on average 50 to 60 hours a week and just throwing an insane amount of money every month at the mortgage and got out of debt. And it's pretty interesting. You know, again, I don't want to come off sounding like a communist. I'm, you know, very much a capitalist. I love the marketplace and free enterprise. But we have a culture, and it's not a conspiracy. No one designed it, but it just, you know, sort of an emergent reaction to incentives. We have a culture where you get into debt early, and most people spend their entire lives in debt. I remember signing student loans when I was, you know, 16.
Oh, you're going to give me flashbacks.
Right. You did to me earlier with 2008. Now it's my turn. at the age of 16. And I was in debt until I paid off the loans at, you know, something like 46 years old. I forget the exact numbers, but I looked at that and realized I had spent 2/3 of my life continuously in debt to someone. You know, I paid off the student loans after college, but by that point I had a mortgage. And by the time the mortgage was paid off, I had a second mortgage on a, you know, different house, all these things. And, you know, people talk about, oh, I'd like to pay off the house around the time I retire or a couple of years after I retire.
Oh, God, what a nightmare.
Exactly.
Oh.
And this is the exact same thing as you're talking about rolling debt with farmers. You know, we do it, you know, as consumers or people living in the suburbs.
The revolving debt on a credit card.
On a credit card or home equity line of credit where, oh, this is wonderful. The market is up. I've got $100,000 of equity in the house. I'll pull out 25 to put in a new kitchen and another 15 so we can all take a great vacation that we've always wanted to.
Because we all know your home is an investment.
Right. Right.
It's not.
Yeah. But a communist friend of mine and I sort of bonded over this that we had both read Debt, the First 5,000 Years by David Graeber.
Ooh, fascinating. I haven't read that one.
And it just talks about going back to at least 3,500 BC. A lot of the early words for freedom basically translated as getting out of debt, going back to your home village.
Nice.
Now that you have paid off your debt and you don't have to be an indentured servant. Gosh, yeah, I'm not a fan of debt, and it's amazing how it's just the default norm where we all assume it has to be that way.
It's very easy to assume, especially when you've grown up in a long period of stability like we've just left, it's very easy to assume that every tomorrow is going to be higher earning than today, and as long as that's the case, debt is, even if it's not wise, it's rational.
Right.
And it's when you're at that change and when the world becomes volatile that it is no longer rational.
Right.
And unfortunately, for all of us, we've entered, in my estimation, we've entered a period of instability that's going to last 20 to 40 years.
I entirely agree with you. I hope not 40, but yeah, this isn't going to be over in three fiscal quarters or even 3 years. This is, we're in strange times.
Yeah, it's, well, for the reason that I think, I'll give you a quick rundown because my audience has heard it before. The reason that I think it's going to be 40 is that the demographic inversion is going to take that long to correct itself, because it takes 40 years to grow a mature taxpayer, and the boomers aren't going to be gone for another 10. So until the demographic pyramid worldwide goes back to normal, where there's more young people than old people, none of the systems that we've invented since World War, well, actually, since the Black Death, are going to function.
Right, right.
Because the whole system since then has been predicated on embedded growth obligations based on increasing population and old age attrition. And between the post-war order and antibiotics and geriatrics and birth control, we've turned all of that upside down worldwide.
Yeah, I agree with that.
That was pretty quick and dirty. So.
Yeah, I like it.
But anyway, we're in a protracted period of uncertainty and volatility, whether it lasts 5 years or 40 years. What we all understand as normal is not coming back anytime soon.
Right. And so to talk about sort of higher variance, I was discussing this with a friend a couple of weeks back, and he was saying, oh, you know, if one wants to invest in the S&P, why not? And whether one does or doesn't, that's a whole another topic that we need not get into. But he was saying, if that's what you want, then have the courage of your convictions and invest in a product that is leveraged 2-to-1. And, you know, I
right. Oh, burn.
I did a quick little model in a spreadsheet, and I posited, you know, at different risk levels. And, you know, if I offer you a bet where, you know, you start out with $100 and, you know, bet me $1 and I'm going to give you a loaded die, 51% chance that, you know, I double your money and 49% chance that I take the dollar away from you. So on average, this is a winning proposition. And if you have a sufficiently large stake, like with $1,000, the variance of $1 bets is so small that you're probably, the game is to just keep playing that over and over and over.
Those are exactly the odds that card counters make their living on in Vegas. I've got some friends that do that.
And, you know, card counters have math that tells them how big their stake has to be relative to, you know, the betting odd. You can't go in there with one bet in your pocket because, you know, if there's a 51% chance that you win, 49% chance that 6 seconds later you're out and you go home. So you have to have...
It takes a couple $1,000 to reliably return 500.
Right, right. And that's, you know, off of a bet size of, you know, say $5 or $10.
Yeah.
And so the more uncertain things get, the more conservative that you want to be with, you know, sort of the mean, you know, average bets. Now, I know Taleb and I know barbell theory about having this, you know, sort of outlier bets, and I'm not disagreeing with that.
Well, what my contention is that as writers, our outlier bets are our books.
Right.
Because there is the unlimited upside if one of them winds up taking the world by storm. Mm-hmm. And then there's the more realistic upside that over the course of our lives, they will return as we get a larger catalog. They will return more and more that we can then roll into other investments.
Right, right. I agree with that.
So I didn't mean to completely cut you off.
Oh, no, no. I was basically, well, so where I was going with that is when things are high variance, you want to make bets, you know, sort of relatively small compared to your total wallet size. And so that's, you know, in this day and age where the S&P is up 8% one day and down 5% and then down 3% and up 5%, and where, you know, we had one plague and who knows if it's going to mutate. And, you know, if you look at the Spanish flu of 1918, we got multiple waves over a couple of years.
Yep.
You know, China is a rising power, North Korea. The world is crazier than it has been since about 1945.
Yep.
And in a world like that, you don't want to be leveraged where 3 weeks without a paycheck and you lose your house.
Yeah.
This is not the time to leverage up and get that McMansion and the BMW you've always wanted. This is the kind of era where you deleverage and you sell your, you know, $500,000 suburban house and buy a $250,000 homestead, you know, 50 miles from the city.
Yeah.
It's a lot more survivable.
Yeah, especially considering what the real estate market is about to do everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's starting to do in some places. And it's not just the plague that's driving people out of the cities.
Mm-hmm.
There's two fundamentals that have been pushing the U.S. real estate market into bananas mode for the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. One of them is, well, I guess 12 years, because there was that dip in 2008. One of them is the incredibly large amount of free money,
mm-hmm.
which is due entirely to the fact that there are too many baby boomers relative to millennials, Xers, and Zoomers.
Mm-hmm.
The credit market is fueled by the retirement investments of the working class.
Mm-hmm.
And when there's too much of that, the costs of money go to zero.
Yep.
And when the cost of money is at zero, your monthly payments are a lot lower for the same amount of house. And so everybody buys.
Right. I agree with everything you said. I think there's more to it than that, though. We're also seeing money printing.
Yep.
And the amount of, money that's been printed up and spent since 2008 is unprecedented.
It's insane. Yeah. And the other thing I was going to go for is foreign capital flight.
And that's what I was going to say next. Great. Yeah. So we agree on the trifecta.
The money is foreign capital flight into the United States from places like China and the European Union, especially since they gave the Cypriot investors that haircut
mm-hmm.
on their private bank deposits in order to solve a debt problem.
Mm-hmm.
Money has just been flooding into the U.S. system from everywhere because
yep.
everybody who's got money that wants it not confiscated by a hostile and collapsing government,
mm-hmm.
which everybody from China to Russia to Germany to Spain is looking at right now, is a complete fiscal collapse in the next 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
The only place on the planet that has property rights that they can go and sink their money into something that they'll be able to get, even if the market crashes, they'll be able to get a piece of it back when they sell,
mm-hmm.
is the United States and Canada. And so capital flight into the U.S. and Canada has been insane.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Bern Hobart is an acquaintance of mine from Twitter, and he has a financial newsletter. And this is pretty much the only thing I pay money to subscribe to besides Fine Woodworking, I believe, which is, an old school magazine. And Bern Hobart talks about this phenomena in depth. And one thing he says is that when you establish a worldwide empire, you have control over everything except, paradoxically, your own currency.
Uh-huh.
We're seeing some of that, all of this capital is flooding in, and it means that the U.S. is the only country in the world that can't really adjust its currency to make its exports competitive on the global market.
Right, and we've solved that problem by just removing ourselves from the global market and establishing a Western Hemisphere for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. On that note, I don't have precise predictions on what's going to happen over the next 10, 15, or 20 years, but in evolution, there's the concept of punctuated equilibrium, sort of not much changes. And the answer is actually, yes, some things are happening sub rosa. There's mutations that are latent and, waiting for conditions to change. And then in the fossil record, in a very short period of time, you get the appearance of all this change happened. And I think punctuated equilibrium is a very good analogy for sort of how the world evolves, that, effectively things haven't changed since 1945. Now, sub rosa, they have lots of new ideas getting generated, lots of, sort of variants are there lurking in the wings. And then at some point in time, the environment changes and certain things that were very well adapted for the old environment are not, and they die off, they go extinct and other things.
And they're doing it fast.
Yeah. And I think that we are very much ending those 70 years of stability, and we are now into 10 or 20 or 30 years of punctuated equilibrium. And it's terrifying, isn't it?
Oh, it is. But I mean, for me, it's personally a massive relief because I've been waiting for this since the wall fell.
Right. Yep.
I was in junior high, but I was enough of a history nut at that time to understand that this means everything has to change.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that nothing did got creepier and creepier and creepier and creepier. And then about 2015, I started digging deep into geopolitics for a science fiction series I'm writing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to see the pieces I was missing and realize, oh, it's coming in 2022 is what I expected. But then the bloody virus hit and moved everything up 2 years.
And so speaking of A, the bloody virus, and B, I was expecting this since the 1990s. I remember reading a book, The Coming Plague, and this was published in 1995.
That was a wonderful book.
Cool. And so, you know, you read that and you read about Ebola Zaire and Marburg. There were a couple of others, and realizing, you know, it's only a matter of time. One of these is going to break out. We've had a few scares, and COVID-19, you know, here it is for real. And this was, again, sort of weird looking at all of the normies and the talking points for months after, you know, some of us online knew. But for months, it's just the flu. Nothing will change. Everything's wonderful. Keep planning on going to that cruise. Keep planning on this. And, you know, I was losing my crap in January. Like, this is it, guys. Yep. Why do you think that if thousands of corpses are stacking up in China that we're not going to see this on our doorsteps in a couple of weeks? And we know how that played out.
The long piece has been just long enough that all of these things have left living memory. So it's only the history nuts and the modeling geeks for whom any of this is not science fiction. And so the developed world population is getting a hell of an education really damn fast. Yep. And it's going to take years for people to integrate it into their mental models of how the world works.
And the sad thing is, you know, the human condition is that even as we're bringing back in the lessons of 1918, you know, whatever the lessons were of, you know, 1925 or 1930, those are probably slipping off.
Yeah, those have well slipped off, but that's a whole other conversation.
Yep.
Oh, man, oh, man. So tell me a little more. You moved out to the farm, what, 4 or 5 years ago now?
Six and a half. So I'm in my seventh year. Yeah.
So what's the development curve and how has that played into and out of your writing career? How have the two worked together?
I've got so many things to say on this topic. One is, so I spoke earlier about having been burned by debt in the wake of 2008. My absolute highest priority was to get out of debt. And so what that meant is that for most of the first 4 or 5 years, I was working, 40 plus hours a week at my primary job Monday through Friday, and then had a second job on the weekend. And then you're also trying to do some farm chores. And that did not leave a lot of time for writing. I did force myself to finish two novels that I'd already half written. And this was my first novel, The Powers of the Earth, which when it was published, won the Prometheus Award for Best Libertarian Science Fiction of 2018. And the sequel, Causes of Separation, which came out and also won the Prometheus Award in 2019. But those, you know, I had already written the first, say, three drafts. And I'm a big fan of rewriting. Writing is rewriting. And so I managed to, you know, force myself to do the fifth draft and the sixth draft and polish it and finally get them out the door. And as a independent consultant, I'm a software engineer, so I'll, you know, work a gig for 6 months. I'll be unemployed for 3 or 4 weeks. I'll get another gig. And so I mostly do my writing during that downtime or perhaps on a weekend. And so I guess there's a couple of things we're talking about. One is financial security of getting debts paid off, and that requires hard work. Another is living on a homestead, and that requires a different kind of hard work, but also the hours. And so there's a lot of irons in the fire there, and there's, you know, self-discipline and working extra hours will only get you so far. So that's not a happy, you know, smiley truth, but it is a truth. Many truths aren't all that happy. But with the farm at this point fully paid off and no debt, I have gone down from 1.5 or 2 jobs to just one job. And this is giving me more time to write. So for the past year, I've been working on the homesteading book. And it's nice to do something that's got value and that you want to, you know, look back and say you've done, as opposed to just cranking out the hours.
We had an exchange on Twitter a few weeks ago. You were getting on someone's case for what it takes to be financially independent.
Mm-hmm.
And I popped in with, it takes startlingly little if you're willing to do what it takes.
The way it started is someone was looking at all of the people in Silicon Valley and Hollywood, et cetera, who you look at and you think, you know, gosh, they're rich, and yet they still don't have the freedom to speak their minds. And this person's conclusion was that, you know, FU money is apparently tens of millions of dollars. And, you know, I disagree. I think it's
Before you do that, I want to define fuck you money for the audience.
Great.
Nassim Taleb defines fuck you money as that amount of money you have in the bank, which will allow you to comfortably tell someone walking through the door with a massive check to fuck off, and your lifestyle won't be affected at all.
Yep. So, you know, I think that there are people who, you know, have $20 million in the bank, but their, you know, their expenses are so high that unless they continue to earn $1 million a year, they are screwed. They're going to go bankrupt and they're going to lose everything. And if you live like that, then you've got problems. My wife, you know, who's read prepping literature and other stuff, had an interesting observation that she had read from somewhere, which is one of the best reasons to be prepared is not just that you've got the supplies on hand, but it means that you are not forced into making terrible decisions under duress.
Yes.
And that's quite interesting. And so under duress is not a state of the universe. It's sort of a state of, you know, your own mental state and your preparation. So if you're a Hollywood actor and the most important thing is to be loved and to get the new jobs that you want with the directors that you want, and you need that steady flow of money, under duress, you are never free to speak your mind or to have your own opinion. And conversely, if you're someone with 1/1000th of that, you know, actor's net worth, you've got a little 3-acre homestead and a 2-bedroom house. It's not even well insulated, but you've got firewood, so it doesn't need to be well insulated. You can be free with a net worth of $60,000 that someone else can't be as free with $60 million.
It is possible to have that kind of freedom and to live well on $1,200 a month for a couple.
I think that's true.
It works fine. You just have to know what you're doing. But yeah, at the root, all of this is really about, there's financial security and whatnot, but at the root of this, financial security is about, we're in a dangerous business, especially in uncertain times. Regardless of where you sit on the political spectrum, there will come a time in the next few years when your ideology, your value set, is up for some serious cultural censure, and hopefully that's where it stops. Having your financial situation sorted out so that if you become the target of the mob, means that you maintain your freedom to speak your mind, to tell the truth as you see it, and to write and behave in the way that you think is ethical.
Back in 2011, I was on the very leading edge of what we now call getting canceled. And Twitter was a lot newer, and I had posted some sort of spicy take. And Radley Balco, who was writing for Reason.com at the time, you know, was put on the spot by someone else and said, you know, certainly you don't support this crazy person who said a spicy joke. And Radley said, no, 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 you know, no true libertarian would make a spicy joke. Senses of humor aren't acceptable. But then to his credit, Radley and I spoke later, and, you know, I disagree with him a lot on politics, but I'm going to defend him as an excellent journalist who has done a lot of good investigatory work and an open-minded guy.
And a fantastic communicator, too. He's a wonderful writer.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's so few really excellent journalists out there. Megan McArdle is another one. Really love her work. But anyway, in this case, Radley Balco sort of wrote up my side of the story later, and he said, you know, Travis conceded that, you know, he said things that were, you know, tasteless and you know, juvenile and, you know, vulgar humor or whatever, but weirdly refuses to apologize. And that is getting exactly to the point you were making, that even if you don't have much money, if you manage it the right way and if you have the right mental attitude, then you can be free on very little. You know, and as we've seen over the last 10 years, apologizing doesn't help.
And anyone who's listening who's wondering why apologizing doesn't help, you need to read up on the Maoist revolution. There's a deep social dynamic power play that's going on at many different levels of the culture wars and the political wars internationally that has played out before, and the best documented instance was the Maoist Revolution. Read Mao's Little Red Book, and then read some good historical accounts of the Maoist Cultural Revolution. You will understand a lot more what's going on. It has very little to do with the ideals people are espousing.
Absolutely agree. You know, I know we agree on a bunch of stuff just from our conversations on Twitter, but I'm glad that we're not looking for something to disagree about, because so far we haven't come up with it.
Oh, we could find some stuff, but hey, what would be the point? There's plenty of time for that on Twitter.
Right. That's what the application is for. You know, every subculture has its topic, but then it has its sort of preferred modes of actual discourse. And so in prepping, you know, everyone wants to talk about what sort of machete is best for chopping off zombies' heads, and should I get the chrome barrel lined AR-15 from this vendor, or should I get the, you know, nitrogen oxide deposited whatever from this vendor?
It's like listening to graphics nerds argue about the relative merits of After Effects and smoke.
Exactly. And, you know, I live in a homestead. I have a basement full of food. I've got firearms. I've got all that good homesteading stuff. I've even got a machete, although I mostly use it for chopping pumpkins in half when I feed them to animals.
Nice.
But the biggest prepping hint, I would say, is just try to, you know, pay down your debt and build up, you know, a little bit of emergency funds, Dave Ramsey style. And I'm sure your readers are, you know, familiar with Dave Ramsey, because in the real world, that lack of panic, that being out of debt and having some funds on hand is worth more than, you know, a dozen zombie chopping machetes.
Yeah, really. And the amount of stress that it relieves is staggering.
Mm-hmm.
Your amount of financial freedom is not measured necessarily by your net worth, and it's definitely not measured by your income. Your financial flexibility is measured by the distance between your monthly income and your monthly outlay.
Mm-hmm.
And your freedom is measured by how long you can go if that situation mm-hmm. goes seriously south.
There is a great Charles Dickens quote, and I think I just found it. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, £19, 19 shillings and 6 pence. Result, happiness. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, £20, aught and 6. Result, misery. And, you know, that is very well stated, that being, you know, it's like if you're out in the water, if your nostrils are 1 inch above the water, you are having a great time shouting and having fun with your friends. If they are 1 inch below the water, you're dying.
Yep, that's it exactly. Given your experience the last few years, is there any other advice you would give to writers who maybe don't mm-hmm. want to move out to the back of nowhere simply to avoid paying rent?
You know, I've got lots of advice on the craft of writing, not a ton on the business of writing. My understanding is that your business as an independent author sort of compounds with something like the square of how many titles you have out there. And that makes sense, that every single title you have out there is a new opportunity for a potential reader to find you. So, you know, you got your A book and your B book and your C book, they stumble in on any given search path. And then once they discover your body of work, they're going to buy a bunch of it. So I would love to have the dozen books that are in my head all out on paper and up at Amazon right now. Sadly, I've only got two novels and a couple of 3-4 short stories.
Well, you should listen to the podcast. It's a lot of it's about everyday yep. productivity.
Well, I am productive as fuck, only.
No, I mean at the keyboard part.
Right, right. And I was about to say, and that's exactly it. One can only have so many number one priorities. And, you know, yesterday I took the day to build bookshelves. And the day before that, I was swinging a pick because I'm putting in a new orchard for cider apples. So, revealed preference.
Yeah, no, I hear you. The last few months have been disastrous for me in the word count mm-hmm. department, because I've had I had the opportunity open up to get a whole bunch of my back audiobook catalog done, and so I've been doing audio engineering all the time, and has not been a lot of time for, because I can, after the last 2 years of remodeling and repairing and refurbishing mm-hmm. houses and learning metal fab and doing all that great stuff, I've lost the ability to do 20-hour days mm-hmm. in the chair anymore, which is great for my health, but it does mean that I have to choose between audio producing and book producing now, which I didn't used to have to do.
Yep. And I would love to plug the homesteading Kickstarter. You've had a lot of questions about homestead stuff, and you know, I've got a whole bunch of Twitter friends who have been sort of watching the homesteading adventure over the last 6.5-7 years. And there have been tons of questions. And so about 5 years back, I started documenting a whole lot of what I was doing and what I was learning. And I was planning on getting that book out in another year or two. But with the COVID-19 and with the urban rioting and arson and all of this other stuff, I sort of thought, you know, I think that there is a taste, a hunger for this topic right about now. Being lucky is good, and being smart is good, but having timing is really good. So fingers crossed. So anyway, by the time this podcast runs, the Kickstarter will be live, and at kickstarter.com, if you search for Escape the City, you will find my. So there's a table of contents. There's pictures of what a farm is like. There's discussions about how much cheaper it is to live in the country than in the city or the suburbs. And I hope that your readers will stop in and check it out. And on the topic of the Kickstarter, you know, I've written novels before. I've run Kickstarters before, and I delivered the products on time, and the results went on to win awards. So I hope that these how-to books will be equally useful to people. And thank you in advance for any support.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on, Travis. And you want to plug your website so people can find your books and stuff real quick?
Sure. MorlockPublishing.com. And I've got a list of my books there. And of course, I'm on Amazon. And the name is Travis Corcoran, C-O-R-C-O-R-A-N.
All right. Thank you very much.
And that is the interview with Travis Corcoran. Thank you very much for listening. As usual, you will find all of the resources mentioned in passing in the show notes so that your reading list will grow even longer than it already is. Meantime, I will be back in 2 days with the rest of the current batch of episodes. There's about 20 of them. And after that, we are on our own for questions again, so do send them in as they occur to you, either as a result of this episode, feeding back on any other episode, or just because you like to ask questions for no readily apparent reason. All of these are welcome. Thank you very much, and we'll be seeing you in a couple of days.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty McKeon, and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer, and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license, and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners. Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.